Thank you so much. My name's John. I'm one of the pastors here at Pillar. It's a gift to be together. I don't know, you can't see it, but I'm looking out the double door entrance through the window. It is snowing sideways. Welcome to Michigan. Makes me think of summer. Kristen and I were married on August 16, 2001, across the street at Dimnit Chapel. It was a hot, muggy, humid day. Anybody been in Dimnit Chapel in a hot, humid, muggy day? So you know what happened then at our wedding. One of the groomsmen, bam, passed out cold, went down. The congregation gasped. Kristen looked. The pastor ran over to offer whatever utterly ill-equipped medical attention he had to offer. The rest of the groomsmen kind of picked him up, sort of carry-dragged him off the stage and had him sitting in the front pew of Dimnit Chapel, where he remained the rest of the service in utter and well-deserved humiliation. The pastor finished the sermon and turned to me and said, John, do you take Kristen to be your wife? And I was like, I do. And he said to Kristen, do you take John to be your husband? And she was like, no, just kidding. She was like, I do. And then he said, what token do you bring? And I grabbed her ring from my best man, the big dog, and she grabbed my ring from her maid of honor, Jackie. We had been preparing for that moment when the pastor would ask about the ring. So when we bought the rings, we wanted it to kind of be like uniquely, personally intimate, you know? So only the two of us actually to this day until now know this, but when we bought the rings, we had engraved on the inside a Bible verse. It was sort of meaningful to us, you know? Guess which Bible verse? From the Song of Songs. Just kidding, no. from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 12, verse 30. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. We engraved that on our rings as a way of guiding us through life. And I'm pretty sure, you know, we engraved it on our rings. I'm pretty sure God's Spirit wants it like tattooed on your soul. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. This is the fifth Sunday in the season of Lent. As our guide, a guiding phrase, we've been borrowing, centered on Christ in a fragmented world. Have we assessed the situation accurately, a fragmented world? Well, Eugene Peterson has been a voice in the back of our heads this season of Lent. Worship is a meeting at the center so that our lives are centered in God and not lived eccentrically. We worship so that we live in response to and from this center, the living God. Failure to worship consigns us to a life of spasms and jerks at the mercy of every advertisement, every seduction, every siren. Without worship, we live manipulated and manipulating lives. We move in either frightened panic or deluded lethargy as we are in turn alarmed by specters and soothed by placebos. If there is no center, there is no circumference. People who do not worship are swept into a vast restlessness epidemic in the world with no steady direction and no sustaining purpose. Peterson's pushing a little on us. And is there anything more center to the gospel than this? Love God. Love neighbor. It's the animating center. It's the dynamism of Christ's life. It's the rubric through which we make our decisions. It's the lens through which we look at all of life. Love God, love neighbor. When marriage is thriving and the kids are behaving, love God, love neighbor. When the conversations are complicated and the bedroom door slams again, love God, love neighbor. Oh, here's one. When the neighbor puts out the sign in the front yard, in an election cycle, and by the way, you're probably not aware of this, this is an election year. And when your neighbor puts out the sign and it's the wrong color and it's the wrong name and you want to make sure your neighbor knows he is wrong, how about employing the tactics of the Christian faith for 2,000 years? And how about this? This is crazy. Love God and love neighbor. Kristen and I engraved it on our rings to remind us what's at the center, and I'm hoping by the end of the morning you'll have it stitched into the lining of your soul. Love God. Love neighbor. Maybe you want to hear the story that surrounds it. Do you want to hear the story that surrounds it? Yeah, okay. One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing one another. And seeing that Jesus answered them wisely, the scribe asked Jesus, "Which commandment is the greatest of all?" And Jesus said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And a second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." And the scribe said to Jesus, "You are right. For you have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other. And to love God with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength. And to love one's neighbor as oneself. This is far more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." And Jesus, seeing that he answered wisely, said, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." From that moment on, no one dared to ask him any other question. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It's Mark 12, 28 through 34, if you want to find it in a Bible near you or the smartphone on you. That's the center. There it is. Love God, love neighbor. In a fragmented, fractured, wild, lonely, confused, exhausted, anxious world, love God, love neighbor. You want a little help navigating your way through this sermon, kind of 2 points, this crazy little thing called love, which I totally made up all by myself, and the wild reality of Jesus. Now, this crazy little thing called love, the scribe shows up and he says to Jesus, "Which commandment is the greatest of all?" Now, the scribes, just so you can orient yourself to the story, the scribes, they're the lawyer types. They're like close cousins with the Pharisees. The Pharisees were all into like the holiness codes and the purity laws. The scribes were more into like the legal details. Like if you had an argument with your neighbor around some real estate property, you'd call in the scribes and they would parse out the details. Or if you're getting divorced, the scribes would be the ones who write out the statement of divorce. Or you know what I'm, those are the scribes. So it's kind of loaded for the scribe to say to Jesus, "Which commandment is greatest of all?" I mean, we know now what he said. Actually, every gospel repeats this story, all 4 of them, which is kind of interesting, and nearly all of the epistles refer to it, which is also kind of interesting. So we kind of, if you grew up in the church and you've like spent any time around the Bible, we've heard this one before. Love God, love neighbor. But can you imagine the first moment? Like, there were a lot of laws. And the scribe, the legal expert, is asking Jesus, "All right, which one's the most important?" I can feel the weight of that moment for Jesus. I mean, first of all, when God was delivering his people from slavery in Egypt, he sent them through the Red Sea out into the wilderness, and then he had Moses go up to Mount Sinai, and God, as a stunning act of grace, pared all of the laws of the natural order down to just 10. And can you imagine that moment, Moses saying to God, all right, thank you, very helpful, appreciate it so much, but of the 10, which one should I pay most attention to? Can you imagine Moses doing that? And then, of course, the 10 get ballooned in the Old Testament. There are 613 laws articulated in the Old Testament. And the scribes and the Pharisees, especially the Pharisees, they were into the law. So they wrote laws about the laws. It's called the Talmud. It's sort of they were building a fence around the law. The idea was if you bump up against the law they made up, you're less likely to trespass the actual law. Does that make sense? They're like those speed, you know, things on the highway. Like when you're going off the highway and you hit the speed things and it makes a bunch of noise, that's like the Talmud, kind of like, hey, you're not off the road, but you're about to be. So now the Pharisees, they've written thousands of laws, into the tens of thousands of laws about the laws, and now the scribe shows up and he's like, "Hey, Jesus, which one?" That's a heavy moment, don't you think? And Jesus doesn't bat an eye. Jesus doesn't hesitate for a second. Jesus borrows the ancient creed of the Jewish tradition. Hear, O Israel, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. I think that's what it is. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And then he adds to it, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And the scribe says, he's like salivating. The scribe is all kinds of excited. He says to Jesus, you're right. Isn't that interesting? Jesus borrows the Shema, adds to it, and the scribe doesn't bat an eye. Because the scribe knew legally what we all know intuitively. Your love of God shows up in the way you treat other people. That's how it goes. That's this crazy thing we call love. They're umbilicated to one another. Have you ever met a person you thought, he is a total jerk? He must love God. Clearly not, because they go together. Your love of God will show up in your life in the way you treat people. Love God, love. I'm not trying, you know what I'm saying? Like, which doesn't mean pat everybody on the back and say, I guess you do you. But it does say, however we hold our convictions, it's got to be held in such a way that our neighbor experiences love. So can I press a little bit? I'm feeling kind of feisty, Walter. You figured that? So let me just press a little bit. Here's, like, in the American church scene, I don't get it, how we can, like in the public sphere, how we can so insist on the primacy of faith in the public sector and its necessity. And, you know, we argue about what's going on in schools or what's not happening in schools. You know what I'm talking about? We're like publicly advocate for faith, and yet our reputation for caring for others is abhorrent. How does this go together? I don't get it. How can we be so vocal about our love for God, and yet our budgets only seem to indicate a love for my feelings, my needs, and my wants, not somebody else? I don't get it. You know, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just trying to be honest. Like, how does this go together? Love of God and love of neighbor, they're umbilicated. They're the same, the obverse and reverse side of the same coin. You know what I'm saying? Since I'm pressing on you, I'll borrow from Mother Teresa. Whenever the pastor is pressing on the congregation, just quote Mother Teresa and everybody feels better. If everyone could see the image of God on his neighbor, do you think we would still need tanks and generals? I got an email from a friend. He was down in South America, like last week, I think it was. He sent me an email on Thursday, or a text. You're going to be in the sermon. Seeing the poor here, walked out of a restaurant this week, and a mother and her kids were picking out the scraps from the garbage. Could have been my leftovers. Getting slapped with these realities often on this trip. Be grateful. Be generous. And then he said, and you're going to love this part, he said, so preach it, bro. So I'm just doing what he asked. So don't be blaming me. You love God? You want people to know you love God? You want people to know how central your love for God is to your life? Love your neighbor. That's this crazy thing we call love. They go together. N.T. Wright pushes even harder. This command comes as a considerable challenge to all contemporary Christians. Would anyone looking at us, our churches, our lives, the societies that claim in some sense to be Christian, ever have guessed that the man we claim to follow saw his followers as people like this? Or to put it another way, when the crisis comes, what remains solid in your life and the life of your community? Wholehearted love of God and neighbor? Or the mad scramble of everyone trying to save their own skins? Love God, love neighbor. Love God, love neighbor. They go together. Is that fair? It's this crazy thing we call love that launches us into the wild reality of Jesus. The scribe shows up to Jesus and asks him, which commandment is the greatest of all? And Jesus recites the Shema and adds, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. The scribe, so there's five sects of Judaism in the first century. There were the scribes and the Pharisees. They were the legal types. Then there were the Essenes. They were the monkish types. Then there were the Zealots. They were the revolutionary types. And then there were the Sadducees. The Sadducees, they were the aristocrat types. They were kind of in the wealthy crowd. Sadducees, they didn't believe in an afterlife. They're probably so contented with what was going on in their own lives currently, they didn't want to talk much about the afterlife. So they didn't believe in the resurrection. So if you go to the story just before this one in Mark's gospel, Jesus is in a conversation with the Sadducees, and the scribe shows up and hears them disputing with one another, which I think is so interesting. The Sadducees were trying to bait and switch Jesus into affirming their perspective that there is no afterlife. And then the scribe shows up, he hears them disputing, he asks the question, which is the commandment is greatest of all. Jesus recites the Shema, and then the scribe says to Jesus, you are right. Can you imagine that moment? Oh, thank you, scribe, thank you. The living God has been affirmed by, you are right. The scribe wasn't saying to Jesus, you got it right. The scribe was basically saying, I've been right all along. Which is the same thing the Sadducees were doing. We've been right all along. And I'm kind of feeling like we still do the same thing. I've been right all along. I just need Jesus to kind of prove my point. You know, just borrow a Bible verse and can proof text my way through this argument. I've been right all along. We use the Bible to condone our prejudices and affirm our practices. When was the last time you changed anything in your life? Anything. Because the gospel of Christ convicted you. When, you know? I mean, I have to ask myself. Because pretty much, we just want a pat on the back and say to Jesus, you're right. In other words, I've been right all along, Jesus. So the scribe says to Jesus, you're right, which I just think is hilarious. And then he repeats the very same thing Jesus had just said. You're right. For you have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other. And to love God with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength and to love one's neighbor as yourself. This is far more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And then Jesus says to the scribe, juxtaposed against what the scribe said to Jesus, the scribe says, you are right. And Jesus says to the scribe, you're not far. You're not far from the kingdom of God. The scribe wanted accuracy. Jesus wants proximity. The scribe wanted perfection. Jesus wants salvation. You're not far. We love God and love neighbor not to one-up somebody, but to draw close to Christ, who himself fulfilled the law, who himself left the communion with Father and Spirit because he loves God and loves the world. He left communion with the Father and the Spirit and entered into the creaturely realities of our finite lives so that we could become like he is. He fulfilled the law, so in our loving God and loving neighbor, we find ourselves close, near Christ. Amen. So Tuesday, I flew from Palm Beach. Yes, I was in Palm Beach. It's a very difficult life I live. I was at a gathering of preachers for a couple of days trying to think about winsome, compelling preaching. So I hopped a flight in Palm Beach and flew to Indianapolis where I met with another group of preachers to talk about the same thing. It was about 10:30 on Tuesday morning. I dropped the rental car off at like Thrifty Rental or something like that. Got in the shuttle over to Palm Beach Atlantic Airport where I got shuttled like cattle into the security. You know, you've been there. All the TSA people are like, while the rest of us are like winding our way. I happened to be standing right behind what I presume to be a 17 or 18-year-old young woman who clearly was in some kind of exchange with her mom and dad who were walking with her through the line, though they weren't flying anywhere with her. So I'm standing there, you know, just like right next to him. She had black Lululemon pants on and a bright pink orange quarter zip. Mom and Dad are giving her all kinds of instructions. Okay, when you get to the gate, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I heard the same instructions over a course of like 3 minutes, like seven times. Finally, Mom and Dad let go of their grasp of their 17-year-old daughter. They get out of line, and I say to the girl with the black Lululemon pants and the bright pinkish-orange quarter zip, tough goodbye? And she said, no, not really. didn't see that coming. The mom, still within earshot, says, it's her first flight. Now, I'm realizing she's like 17 and I'm 47. She's probably, you know, it's probably awkward for her. So I just, like, I'm not going to talk to her. I'll just throw my shoes off in the bin and I'll get through the line and go on my way. So that's what I do. And then I like to walk in airports because otherwise I get super lethargic. So I'm just kind of walking up and down Concourse B. And now it's time to get on the plane, and we all move like the cattle we are over to the boarding gate, and I'm standing right next to the girl with the black Lululemon pants and the pink orange quarter zip. And I just said something like, this is crazy. And she said, yeah. Now, she had a boarding priority above mine, which was, I was not pleased by this. So this 17-year-old girl, she gets on the plane way before I do, and by the time I get on the plane, there's no more room for my carry-on, and I am not happy. So I get on the plane, she's, I don't know where she is, and I sit in seat 25D, which is on the aisle. Of course it's on the aisle, so that I can lean into the aisle and not touch the person next to me while the flight is happening. Problem was, normally I get the exit row, so I pay like $79 for an inch and a half more of legroom. In this case, I'm sitting in 25D right next to the bathroom. Has anybody been on a flight next to the bathroom? It is by far the worst seat on the entire airplane. They should, like, block them off. They should have, like, you know, police tape around the aisle right next to the bathroom. So what's happening is I'm sitting there leaning into the aisle, trying to stay away from her, while people are coming up the aisle, opening the door of the bathroom, and then they have to get around the door, so they're like slapping me while I'm trying to read, and then they use the restroom, and I'm right there, and they get out of the restroom, and they do the same thing, and they, excuse me, sir, and I'm just kind of like, So finally I realized if you can't beat them, you join them. So I got up to use the bathroom too, and I just stood there for like 5 minutes, just kind of washed my hands and looked for the paper towel, couldn't find any, so I'm wiping my hands as I open up the door, and guess who's standing there? The girl with the black Lululemon pants and the bright pink orange quarter zip. You know, she eventually goes to sit down way in the front of the plane. How did she get to sit way in the front of the plane where me and all the steerage are in the way back over here? So anyway, I sit there. The flight finally lands. This story has a point. Eventually, you'll get to lunch. Now we're in Atlanta. Anybody been at Atlanta? It is huge. It is like a city. And I get off the plane, and I look at the monitor to see, you know, where I'm supposed to go. I'm supposed to go to A32, but right now I'm in Concourse B, which means I've got to walk all the way through Concourse B, down an escalator, onto a train, up an escalator, over to A32. So I grab the one bag I was allowed to take on the plane, and I walk through Concourse B, down the escalator, onto the train, get off the train, and I'm standing about to hop on the escalator, and guess who's standing right there? The 17-year-old girl with the black Lululemon pants and the bright pink, orangish quarter zip. And I, at this point, just said, this is wild. And she said, yeah. And she said, where are you going? And I said, Indianapolis. She said, how about you? I said, how about you? She said, Columbus. And I thought to myself, why? Would anyone, they have flights to Columbus? Who goes to Columbus? So we're on the escalator now, and, you know, you got like 18 seconds of standing there. And she said, yeah, I'm going to see a friend. We've been friends since preschool. He and I even share the same birthday. We're going to turn 18 on the same day. Oh, that's really nice. She said, yeah, he has cancer. I said, oh, no. So sorry. What kind? She said, it's in his spine and in his brain. I'm going to say goodbye. I thought, oh, I'm so sorry. And we're up at the top of the escalator, and I'm believing to myself, I'm never going to see this girl again. So I just said, hey, I want you to know I'm thinking of you while you say goodbye to your friend. And she said, thanks. She walked away. And I walked to A32. I just thought to myself, this 17-year-old girl left her mom and dad in Palm Beach, flew through Atlanta to get to Columbus to say goodbye to her friend dying of cancer. Young lady, you are not far from the kingdom of God. Love God, love neighbor. Not to achieve some moral perfection, not to be right, to be close. It's about proximity. And friends, you are not far from the kingdom.